Good morning, everybody. I know I was really tired when I got to work today, too, but I'm slowly waking up. And let's see where we are in class. I'll get this microphone working. Looks good. All that looks good. I'll turn the lights down in just a second. Okay, all the lectures are online in case you guys want to check those lectures out. And I'll try to get today's lecture online really fast as well. And we'd like to keep the lights like that. Okay, the schedule for today is July 20th. All right, so this is Bio 231, July 20th. And I see that we're going to move into endocrine system today, finish up special senses, and then tomorrow is exam number 3. All right, chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And just follow the study guides for what could be on the test. And I had a question over the weekend, where's the study guide for the endocrine chapter? There isn't an online assignment or weekly assignment. All right, but hopefully there's a study guide. Let's see where that study guide could be. Okay, come on, keyboard. Okay, let's see what's happening here. Please let me in. Oh, good. Okay, so here is your blackboard pre-lecture. There's no pre-lecture reading assignment, syllabus, lecture recordings, study guides. Here's study guides, special senses, tissues. Ah, here it is. Study guide for chapter 17, endocrine system. All right, so hopefully you found that. And if not, please just check because it's right there. Okay, it's just not in this big long list. All right, it's just right here. All right, so let's finish up. Unless there's a question on the schedule, I tell you what, let me go back to the schedule for just a second because there is one other important thing. So today's Monday the 20th. Tomorrow is exam number 3 in lecture. And I will try to be here early, like maybe around 8 o'clock or before 8 o'clock, in case somebody wants to start the test early to give yourself some more time. So you need a Scantron pencil, a super good eraser, and a picture ID, and then you're good. That's on Tuesday. On Wednesday, the 22nd, is the third practicum. And we've covered pretty much everything in lab that will be on that practicum. So today and tomorrow are kind of like review days or cover material that you haven't had a chance to look at yet. And I do believe our tutor is going to be in lab during that time as well. Okay, and I don't want to say his or her name to be put on the internet. Okay, so make sure you come to lab to prepare for practicum number 3. And then you're going to be 3/4 of the way done with the class. Okay. So I'll put the schedule away unless I have a question. No question. Fantastic. All right, so let's finish up the senses chapter. And I don't think I want to say anything else about the eye. So let's start looking at the ear. Here is the ear. And the ear has some external pieces to it. Right, including the auricle, right here. Sometimes that's called the pinna. It's got different parts. All these little structures have parts, but you just have to know that this is the auricle or pinna of the ear that helps focus sound into the temporal bone. And the way it enters the temporal bone is through the external acoustic meatus, which is right here. All right, and so all of these structures make up the external ear. As sound enters, right, it's going to bump up against a membrane called the tympanic membrane. What's another name for tympanic membrane? Everybody's aware of this. Everybody knows this. It is the eardrum, right, because it bounces back and forth when sound pressure hits it. Right? And so that now is the beginning of a part of the ear we call the middle ear. And in the middle ear, you have the tympanic membrane. You have three little bones. These are called ossicles. Right? So you have the malleus, incus, and stapes. They're named pretty much after what the shape of the bones are, like the stapes right here. Kind of looks like a stirrup you would put your foot into when you're riding a horse with a saddle on it. Right? And right here, where you put your foot on this little platform right here, what shape does this have? Does this have a triangle or a square, a rectangle, a rhomboid? What are some of my other choices? What does this look like to you right here? Somebody's got to tell me, what does that look like to you? What shape? What shape does that look like? Like if you were to take the stapes out and punch it down on a piece of paper, put some ink on this thing right here. So not this, not that, not that. But the shape of this thing right here that I'm circling. That looks like an? All right, I heard it. It's an oval. Yeah, it looks like an oval, right? It's not a circle, not a square, or a triangle. It looks like an oval. Tympanic membrane is pretty circular. Okay, and so you got these auditory ossicles. There's some muscles in there as well that can contract and prevent the vibration of these auditory ossicles when sound pressure is really, really high. And when these auditory ossicles vibrate, then the stapes also vibrates another membrane, another window that takes sound energy into this inner part of the ear. Okay, and the inner part of the ear, we call it the labyrinth. It has three main pieces to it. This thing that looks like a snail is the cochlea. This thing right here just kind of looks like a bulb. That's the vestibule. And then these are what we call the semicircular canals. So those are the three pieces of the labyrinth, the bony labyrinth. Cochlea, vestibule, semicircular canals. We're going to look at the inside of these things after we get this basic orientation done. Okay, so the tympanic membrane's got to vibrate back and forth. So the pressure in this middle ear should be the same as, or the atmospheric pressure in the middle ear should be the same as the atmospheric pressure in the external ear, so that this tympanic membrane can actually vibrate back and forth right around that pressure level. If the pressure level increases in the middle ear, right, it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way out like this, and then it won't be able to vibrate. It's just stuck over here. Or if the pressure in the external is a lot higher than the internal, then the outside pressure is going to push the tympanic membrane way into the middle ear, and it won't be able to vibrate. So the pressure across the tympanic membrane has to be equalized. And I'm sure maybe some of you have equalized your ear. Maybe you've driven up into the mountains and you can't hear very well. And then all of a sudden maybe you feel something in your ear, maybe hear a squeak or something, and all of a sudden you can hear a lot better. All right, and that is the ear equalizing pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. And how it does that is through this tube right here. Here's a tube that connects the middle ear with the pharynx. And the pharynx is just a fancy anatomic name for your throat. All right, so here is a tube that connects your middle ear with your throat. So sometimes when you clear your ears, you actually pinch your nose, okay, close your mouth, and pressurize air in your mouth and chest, and that force, oh, I can hear a lot better since I was demonstrating that to you, like that. We call that a Valsalva maneuver, and that helps force a little air through this auditory tube. You can call it auditory tube, you could call it eustachian tube, or you could call it the pharyngotympanic tube, which is just a name of the two places that this tube connects. Right, the tympanic membrane to the pharynx, and the pharynx is just another name for the throat. It helps clear the middle ear, right, or equalize pressure. All right, so those are the three main parts of the ear. Right, you got external, you got middle, and then the inner ear. Okay, so the three senses, the inner ear actually has three senses. The cochlea is responsible for hearing, and the vestibule is responsible for static equilibrium. The semicircular canals are responsible for dynamic equilibrium. And hearing, we know what that means, right? But for static equilibrium, what the heck does that mean in everyday language? Static equilibrium just means linear acceleration. This part of your ear can sense linear acceleration. And you know what acceleration is? It's when you're changing your speed, like going from 0 miles per hour to 60 miles per hour. All right, that is acceleration. So acceleration is not speed. If you're traveling at a constant speed, like 100 miles an hour, you are not accelerating. It's only a change. All right? Or if you change your speed from 60 to 0, that's acceleration, but we call that deceleration. Right? So that's what the organs in the vestibule can sense. The semicircular canals are sensing acceleration, but not in a linear fashion like the vestibule. They can sense angular acceleration. And another name for angular is spinning. Right? So when you start to spin one way or the other, the semicircular canals can then tell your brain that you have begun to spin in one direction or another. There are three semicircular canals. I only see two on this particular drawing, but there are three because, remember, there are three planes that we can cut the body into, right? So here would be a coronal, here would be a transverse, and then there's another one up over here, which would be a sagittal plane. So there are actually three that line up with the planes, the orthogonal planes that make up our body. Okay, so you got hearing for cochlea, linear acceleration for vestibule, angular acceleration for semicircular canals. All right, so the sound enters the cochlea via the oval window. All right, so this illustration is really handy because it's a key, it's an answer key to what a question might be on the exam. How does sound enter the cochlea via the oval window? Sound energy goes into the cochlea, rattles around in there, and that sound energy has to be released, otherwise the cochlea is going to be damaged. And there is another window right about here, you'll see it in lab, and right, can you see what the shape of this window looks like right here? Does it look like a triangle? It's not, doesn't stand out quite so much like the oval window, okay? And that is the round window. It has just a round shape to it right here. So sound goes in the oval window. It's released back into the middle ear via the round window. In oval, out round. Okay, so here is the organ for sensing, for the sense of hearing. Ah, yeah, here's a round window. This is just a zoomed in region of the figure that we were looking at so far. Okay, here are those auditory ossicles. Here are some muscles that can dampen these vibrations when sound pressure gets too loud so that it protects your ear. Right, the tensor tympani muscle is one, stapedius muscle is another, and maybe you've experienced that. Maybe you have been driving in your car for a long period of time, and when you start getting on the freeway, the noise in your car gets louder and louder and louder, and you're listening to music or a traffic report, and then it's hard to hear, right, that music. So what do you do to your radio or CD player or your 8-track player? Or your cassette player, what do you do to the volume as the noise of your car gets louder and louder? You turn the volume up, right, so that you can hear it. And then sooner or later, I know my wild nephews do this, right, they turn the volume up to maximum, right, to where you can't even make it any louder anymore, right? And then you get to where you're going, turn your car off, get out of your car, and then you come back to your car after a period of time, start it up, and what does the radio sound like? It's blasting like crazy, right? It's so loud you can hardly hear it. Well, what has happened when you were in the car the first time? Well, these muscles right here dampen the vibrations of those auditory ossicles so that when you get into the car afterwards and these muscles are relaxed, your radio is just blasting, almost hurting your ears, right? Okay, so that's the job of the tensor tympani and stapedius muscles. So the bony labyrinth is the cochlea. The vestibule is a part of the bony labyrinth and the semicircular canals. And now you can see all three semicircular canals. We call that the bony labyrinth, and there is a membranous labyrinth on the inside that contains organs for hearing, for static equilibrium, for dynamic equilibrium. So let's take a look at that membranous labyrinth. And then here are the nerves that attach to the cochlea and vestibule, right? And so this used to be called the auditory nerve, but now it's called the vestibulocochlear nerve. It's a cranial nerve because it comes from the vestibule and the cochlea, right? So that actually makes perfect sense. And if you see that, then you realize that the name of auditory nerve is actually simplified, and it tells you what the origin of these sensory nerves are. All right, you should be able to tell me what cranial nerve that is as well. Okay, if we cut, I want to see if I can show you a cut. Oh, can I show you a cut through the cochlea? Okay, so here's the cochlea. Let's make a cut through the cochlea like this, and then let's look on the inside of it. All right, so here we have a bunch of wrappings around each other. And if we cut through it, we're going to see something like this. All right, so here is one of the tubes, which is really large. And as it gets more toward the center of the ear, these canals get a little bit smaller and smaller and smaller. Then finally, here's the tip. The helicotrema is actually the tip. All right, and so I see one, two, three chambers in the structure. So let's zoom into this chamber right here. So the one on the top, okay, is called the scala vestibuli. This one is connected to the oval window. So this is how sound enters the cochlea. And then depending on the shape of this middle part, this middle chamber right here, this middle part is going to vibrate back and forth. So sound enters oval window into the vestibuli, moves across, right, the cochlear duct, and then into the scala tympani, which is connected to the round window, and that's how sound leaves. So sound enters, sound vibrates this middle part, which is the cochlear duct, and then leaves, right, the scala tympani via the round window. And let's zoom into this region, because this is the region that will allow us to hear sound. All right, so here is the cochlear duct, and it's filled with a fluid. Here is a membrane that's kind of stiff, and sound can vibrate this pectoral membrane based on its shape, right? Things will have a tendency to vibrate at a particular frequency depending on their shape. Can you think of an example in that you have ever seen where the shape of something determines what frequency it vibrates or what pitch you hear? That's a clue. What pitch you hear. So the frequency is the same thing as the note or the pitch that you can hear. So you can hear musical instruments, right? So how is it that different musical instruments can play different notes? How about a piano? There are strings inside a piano that make a particular note. Do you think all the strings are the same diameter, same length in a piano? No, they're not, right? So the smaller something is, the shorter it is, the thinner the diameter, the higher the frequency that will be produced when that string is vibrated. The longer the string, the thicker the string, the lower the frequency will be. Same thing with this pectoral membrane within the cochlear duct. High frequencies will be able to excite the pectoral membrane if the pectoral membrane is small and short, right? Low frequencies will be able to excite a pectoral membrane that is large and thick. And so there are different shapes of pectoral membrane as you go from the oval window to the tip of the cochlea, which is the helicotrema. So when this pectoral membrane vibrates, depending on its position within the cochlea, it will bend the stereocilia. So here is a receptor cell. You would need a microscope to see this. And these receptor cells have these projections, which kind of look like cilia, right, onto the pectoral membrane. So when the membrane vibrates, so do these stereocilia. And when the stereocilia bend, it changes the electrical properties of these cells that we call hair cells, because they have the cilia on top of them, which reminded somebody of hair. And for sure, right, realize that these are things more like cilia rather than hair. They just look like hair at a microscopic level, right? So they're called hair cells. And then those electrical properties are sent to the brain via the vestibulocochlear nerve, or the cochlear division of the vestibular cochlear nerve, to the temporal lobe, which is where your primary auditory cortex is, right? So your primary auditory cortex has to receive these nerve impulses in order for you to appreciate sound. Right, so this is a pretty nice common theme. Here are the stereocilia that we can see. Right. Well, why is that cochlea? Why does it look like a snail? Right. It's all wound up on itself. Let's unwind it, right? If we were to unwind it, it would just be a nice straight linear projection coming from the oval window right here. And if that were the case, right, then it would be a lot longer, right, if we were to unwind it, and then it would not fit inside the temporal bone. You would have the cochlea like sticking out of your head on either side in order for you to hear, but evolution has figured out a way to roll it up so it fits in a much smaller space. All right, so let's take a look at this illustration. Here is part of the external ear, right? The external acoustic meatus, tympanic membrane, auditory ossicles in the middle part of the ear, the malleus, incus, and stapes. These vibrate when the tympanic membrane vibrates the oval window, which is connected to the scala vestibuli, and then that sound energy is going to move across the cochlear duct based on the shape of the cochlear duct at some point. Right? The shape is going to be different all the way along from oval window to the helicotrema. That energy then enters the scala tympani and then is released by the round window so that the cochlea isn't damaged when all that energy enters. So the way that this works is that high frequencies, based on shape of that tectorial membrane, move across the cochlear duct closest to the oval window. Low frequencies have to penetrate. They go way deep inside the cochlea and move across the cochlear duct near the helicotrema. So either end of this cochlea, just think of it as a nice straight line, vibrate at different frequencies, right, based on the shape of that tectorial membrane. High frequencies over here by the oval window, low frequencies close to the helicotrema, and then mid-range frequencies cross in areas between those two regions. All right, so what kind of instrument have you seen where you might have high frequencies played on one side, mid-range frequencies, middle frequencies in the middle, and low frequencies on the other end of that instrument? Have you ever seen a musical instrument kind of laid out just like that? Okay, so I'm thinking of piano. All right, piano has low frequencies way on the left, high frequencies way on the right, and in between frequencies right in the middle. Guitar is laid out that same way, where you have big thick strings on the top and really thin ones on the bottom, and so the big thick strings play the low frequency notes and the thin ones the high frequency, and then middle shaped strings in between. Violins, bass, fiddle, all of these instruments, right, are laid out that particular way, just like the cochlea. All right, so that's how that cochlea works. Let's look at the vestibule, which is important. Can anybody remember what the vestibule is important for? Important for static equilibrium, and that's the same thing as linear acceleration. So let's take a look and see how these two organs within the vestibule can sense linear acceleration. Right, the two organs are called the utricle and saccule. These are both called maculae, and they can sense linear acceleration in different directions. So here is, here we see just an epithelium with some of these receptor cells in them, and these receptor cells have stereocilia on the top of them. What did we call these cells that had stereocilia that were in the cochlear duct? They were called hair cells. And guess what? These are called hair cells as well. right, because they have these stereous cilia. They don't reach up and touch a tectorial membrane. They touch a different kind of structure. This is what we call a gelatinous mass. Stereocilia poke up into this gelatinous mass that can move around depending on how gravity is going to push it. It can sag one way or the other, right? It's not quite a fluid, but it's kind of like a jelly material. To give it weight, right, that jelly-like material doesn't have a lot of weight, but to give it weight, look what's embedded on the opposite side of this gelatinous mass. It is otoliths. What does oto refer to again? Oto, like an otoscope. The otic region on your body is your ear, right? And lith means crystal. So here you have some calcium carbonate crystals. You actually have crystals in your ear that allow you to sense linear acceleration. Okay. And when you start to accelerate, then these otoliths pull on this gelatinous mass, which then bend the stereocilia, which changes the electrical properties of the hair cells, which then sends different kinds of electrical impulses to the brain so that you have a sense of acceleration. Okay, so you have these two organs, the utricle and saccule. So if you are standing straight up with your head upright, the gelatinous mass just pushes straight down on the stereocilia and they don't bend. But as soon as you tilt your head forward, this gelatinous mass starts to flow and sag, right, anteriorly. These otoliths help that, and look what happens to the stereocilia. They start to bend as well. And that changes these electrical signals that go to the brain. So you will have that sense of acceleration. Okay, when you tilt your head. So you have a good idea of body position, right, because of those maculae. All right, so we talked about the cochlea. Oh, I forgot to say something about this cochlea. All right, the cochlea, let's look at, passed it right here. Okay, let me go back to here. All right, so here we see the three canals within the cochlea. This makes up the membranous labyrinth, right? The scala vestibuli, cochlear duct, scala tympani make up the membranous labyrinth inside the bony labyrinth of the cochlea. And here is the organ that senses sound, and that is called the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti is the organ responsible for hearing sound. And then here it is here. It's also called the spiral organ. I like to call it organ of Corti. All right, so the organ for hearing is organ of Corti. The organs for linear acceleration are what? The utricle and saccule. Now we're ready to talk about the semicircular canals. All right, so here are the three semicircular canals oriented in the three different planes that make up our body. And here is another gelatinous mass. It doesn't have otoliths. There's no crystals in it. And it's called the cupula. And embedded in the cupula are the stereocilia from these receptor cells. What do we call these receptor cells once again? These are hair cells, even though these really aren't hairs. These are what, microscopic little cilia sticking up into the cupula. And when the stereocilia bend, that changes the electrical properties of the hair cells, which then changes nerve impulses that go to the brain via the vestibular division of the vestibular cochlear nerve. Okay, so why is it that the cupula can bend one way or the other? Well, there is fluid in these semicircular canals right here, and it's called endolymph. And this fluid can actually flow in a circle through these circular canals depending on your spinning, right? So the semicircular canals with the organ for that sense is called the crista ampullaris. And the crista ampullaris can sense angular acceleration, not linear acceleration, but angular acceleration or spinning, a change in the rate of spinning. How does it do that? Well, there's a property that mass has, right? Mass has a property of inertia. Does anybody know what inertia means? What does inertia mean? I think I have a little, I can come up with an example. What does inertia have? Mass has inertia, which means mass, like here is my coffee cup. The coffee cup we're going to pretend is endolymph. And then here is a piece of paper. We're going to pretend this is the cupula. All right. Cupula is attached to your body. Right? The fluid is just floating around inside the semicircular canals. And so what does inertia mean? And that fluid is mass, so it has inertia. Inertia means that if there is a mass that's stationary, it does not like to move. It just likes to stay put. And then the converse of that is true as well. Once mass starts to move with a constant velocity, it likes to stay at that velocity. Right? It doesn't like to change velocity. So if something is still, likes to stay still. If it's moving at a speed, likes to stay at that particular speed. So let's see if we can we demonstrate, can I demonstrate inertia? Maybe. So the paper, remember, is a cupula. This is endolymph. When you start to move, okay, so this piece of paper is going to move, but what about the endolymph in the semicircular canals when you begin to move? Its mass, it likes to stay put, okay? So I don't know when the next holiday is coming up, but you might go on a picnic someplace and, oh, let's make it even better. You might go on a picnic someplace and you might set a table, right, with all kinds of food and drinks and stuff like that. Nice tablecloth, right? And so you can demonstrate to everybody and say, hey, I know something about inertia. Let me pull out the tablecloth and nothing on the table is going to be disturbed. Right? And so you walk up to the table and you yank the tablecloth. What's going to happen to all that mass that's sitting on the table? Will it want to move or does it want to stay there? It will want to stay because it has inertia, right? It's not moving because it's mass. It will just stay. Should I try to demonstrate that right now? Let's see. I'm too close. Okay, let's try it. Ooh, look at that. All right. So, right, your head and the cupula started to move, but the endolymph didn't. And as a result, this endolymph, because it's standing still, will push on the cupula. It will bend the cupula and the hair cells, and it will send those electrical impulses to the brain. Okay, so do I have that as a figure? Oh, pretty good. Right, so as you start to spin, the endolymph is going to push the cupula. And if you spin for a long period of time, the endolymph catches up, right? If you spin for a long period of time, when the endolymph is moving at the same angular speed as the cupula, then it's not going to push on the cupula one way or the other. All right, so you're spinning. You've been spinning for 2 minutes, right? And you did this over the weekend. And, right, the endolymph caught up with you, and now you stop. So the cupula stops with you. What about that endolymph? What's another property of inertia? When something is moving, it doesn't like to stop, right? So you stop the cupula, and what happens to the endolymph? It's still moving. It's going to push on the cupula the other way, change the direction of bend of the stereocilia. That sends that information to the brain. All right, so you can, did you ever do that? Probably, like I said this weekend. You spin and spin and spin and spin, and then all of a sudden stop, and you look out, and what does the world look like when after you stop spinning? You stop spinning, but now the world kind of looks like it's spinning, right? Because the cupula is trying to find that new equilibrium because the endolymph, right, is giving the brain the information that you're still spinning. So how is that possible? Well, let's try this experiment again. So remember, here's the paper is cupula, and this drink right here is the endolymph. If I get this drink moving and then stop the cupula really fast, what's going to happen to this fluid right here? Got to make sure it's closed. It's going to want to stay moving, right? So the, remember, this cup is endolymph, and I'll get it started, and then I'll stop. Oh, look at that. It kept moving, right? Just like the endolymph in the semicircular canals. And as it's moving, even though the cupula has stopped, it's going to bend, it's going to push up against the cupula the other direction, and then your brain will know what's going on. Okay, so those are the three senses. This organ, right, is called the crista ampullaris. So the organ for hearing is organ of Corti. The organs for static equilibrium are the macule and the saccule and utricle. Those are both maculae. And the organ for angular acceleration is the crista ampullaris. And the reason why this is called the Crista ampullaris is because, let me go back a couple slides. Oh, this is good. Right here. Pretty good. Oh, even better. All right, so we're looking at the bony labyrinth. Here are the three semicircular canals. At the base of a semicircular canal on one end, there's a little bulge. This little bulge contains the crista ampullaris. And somebody looked at this little bulge right here, and it reminded them of a little vial. Maybe you would put medicine in or something. And sometimes, what is that little vial called? It's called an ampule, right? A little ampule with a one dose of medication in it. All right, so this is an ampule, and the crista ampullaris is on the inside of it. Here it is right here. Let's look on the inside. The semicircular canals have the crista ampullaris, right, which is the cupula and the hair cells all put together. So there are three different kinds of sense organs. Now, what about the receptor cell for hearing, for linear acceleration and angular acceleration? What's the receptor cell? Just a common name for it. It is called, here it is right here, in the crista ampullaris. It is a hair cell. And in the utricle and saccule, what are these things called? Hair cells. Are you kidding me? No, you're not kidding me. It's called a hair cell, right? And so this one over here, these hair cells are for angular acceleration. These hair cells right here are for linear acceleration. And what about these cells within the organ of Corti? These hair cells here. Oh, I was going to ask you, what's the name of these cells right here? These are hair cells, right? So you have basically all the same kind of cells that are receptor cells for hearing, linear acceleration, and angular acceleration. It's all the same receptor cell. And that's kind of funny that your body uses, or it's amazing that your cell uses one kind of cell and your perception is completely different depending on what part of the brain these electrical signals go to. All right, so one is for hearing, one's for linear acceleration, the other is for angular acceleration. That's pretty amazing, the same cell. All right, so linear acceleration is balance, right? It's a sense of balance. Hearing is not a sense of balance, but it is in the organ in the inner ear. Balance has two parts, right? The static equilibrium and kinetic. And these are in the inner ear as well. They require hair cells. And static equilibrium, oh, write this down. Static equilibrium is the same thing as linear acceleration that we have right here. Kinetic equilibrium is the same thing as angular acceleration. And remember, angular acceleration is like spin. Okay, that's a nice way to think of it. All right, and then here are the receptor organs. All right, so those are the, how many special senses? We looked at gustation, we looked at olfaction, we looked at taste, all right, we looked at vision, we looked at hearing, static and kinetic equilibrium. So that's seven special senses, and they're called special senses because you can perceive these different modalities of energy just in one or two locations on your body, right? So you can appreciate light, or you have vision because of your eyes. Only in those two places on your head, on the anterior part of your head, can you sense light. Nowhere else can you do that, right? And it's the same for balance, right? Both kinds of equilibrium, for taste, for hearing, and for smell, right? Just a couple special locations, and that's why those are called special senses. All right, who's got a question on these special senses and why they're called special senses? Okay, I don't see any questions. So let me try to find endocrinology pictures. Which are right here. Okay, so the endocrine system is a lot like the nervous system. It can send signals and it can coordinate different parts of your body, right? But it takes much longer period of time to coordinate all of these different parts of your body. It's not fast, right? It doesn't send electrical impulses. Remember, an electrical impulse can travel at hundreds of miles an hour, but a signal from the endocrine system cannot, right? It goes relatively slowly, right? But the nervous system has almost an immediate effect, but it is short-lived. It only has an effect for a short period of time. The endocrine system, on the other hand, the signals take a long time to get to where they're going to go and have an effect, but their effect will last for a long time. And that's pretty much a law of the universe that I don't really know how to describe, but you'll find this to be true in a lot of different things. If there is a drug that has an almost immediate effect, it means that the effect will last for a short period of time. Okay? If there's a drug that will take a longer time to have an effect on your body, it will mean that will be more long-lasting. That's typically how things go. Like there are some barbiturates, when you inject them into somebody, they'll have almost an immediate effect, but if you wait a short period of time, they will wear off. There are other kinds of barbiturates that if you give them to somebody, it will take a while for them to have an effect, but guess what? That effect will last a longer period of time. That just seems to be how things go. Same thing for the endocrine system. So what the heck is the endocrine system? Okay, so here I see some endocrine glands in this person's body, right? And remember, a gland could be of two kinds. It can be a gland that has a duct, which is called an... a gland that has a duct? That is an exocrine gland. A gland that does not have a duct is called an endocrine gland. So endocrine glands are ductless. All right, so all of these things right here, like the pineal, pituitary, hypothalamus, thyroid, adrenal, pancreas, testes, right? Oh, here's an ovary over here, so here's a person that has both. It's rare if that happens. Okay, these organs secrete a compound called a hormone, right? And it doesn't secrete it into a duct. So how does that hormone get around the body? It's picked up by the vascular system, by the blood, and then the blood delivers it everywhere in the body. So endocrine glands don't have to have a duct. All right, so let's look at some definitions right here. All right, endocrine system, or a hormone, is a signaling compound secreted by an endocrine gland. And a hormone is a chemical, you could say a compound, that is secreted by a ductless gland. And what is a ductless gland, once again? It's an endocrine gland, directly into the blood or circulation, where it travels to a distant target tissue and elicits a specific response. That's a really good definition of a hormone. Covers all the bases, all right? So this hormone is going to go everywhere in your body, but it can only coordinate certain tissues that we call a target tissue if it has what? It has to be able to sense that signaling compound. What is that? What do those cells or that tissue have to have? A receptor, right? In order for you to see light, you need photoreceptors, right? So these target tissues need a receptor. If they don't have a receptor, then they're going to be completely ignorant of that particular signaling compound. That won't have any effect. All right, so what are some of the functions? All right, well, it regulates hormones, regulate growth, metabolism, reproductive system, blood chemistry, immune response, and many, many, many more things. And remember, the regulation is a relatively slow process, but it lasts a long period of time. It complements the nervous system. Here are some examples of endocrine glands. Pituitary. Pituitary is at the base of the brain. And maybe on the models you saw a place where it sits in the sphenoid bone. When we looked at the cranial bones, that was the sella turcica, right smack in the middle of your brain. Pineal gland is really close to the hypothalamus. It's above the hypothalamus. Sometimes the pineal gland is called the epithalamus. What does epi mean, once again? Means on top, right? So pineal gland is on top. Thyroid and parathyroid gland are in your neck. Thymus is in your mediastinum. Do you know where your mediastinum is? Part of the thoracic cavity that separates the right and left, that separates the right and left pleural cavities, right? That's the mediastinum right above the heart. And the heart's in the mediastinum as well. The adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla are two different kinds of endocrine glands. pancreas is an endocrine gland. It's also an exocrine gland. It's exocrine because it secretes digestive enzymes into a tube that carry it to the digestive system. But the pancreas is also an endocrine gland because it secretes something. Does anybody know what hormone the pancreas secretes? I would guess many people know. It secretes insulin. And what is insulin really important for? Regulating blood glucose levels. All right, so if the pancreas gets damaged and can't secrete insulin, what disease process does that cause? That causes diabetes mellitus in particular, right? And that can be many other causes for diabetes mellitus, but that would be one of them, right, if the pancreas stops to function. Thymus, gonads, right? Gonads are the same thing. A testes is a gonad and an ovary is a gonad. And the testes secretes testosterone and for supporting male sexual function and male sexual characteristics, right? And the ovaries secrete a couple other kinds of hormones, not testosterone, but estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen and progesterone. So females have two sex hormones. Males only have one sex hormone, and you ladies should be really considerate of us poor males that only have one sex hormone while you have two, okay? Okay, some others. The heart, digestive tract, kidneys, and skin are endocrine glands because they secrete a hormone or a couple kinds of hormones. Most of these glands are epithelial origin, but some can be derived from other tissues in the body, like nervous tissue and muscle, but they're kind of rare. Most people just generally accept that endocrine glands come from epithelial tissue. And that wouldn't be a bad guess. All right, some classes of hormones. Okay, classes of hormones. Some can be amino acids. And amino acids are soluble in water. Amino acids can be used to make proteins. That's a building block of protein, amino acid. Some are steroids. Steroids are lipids, and remember, oil and water don't mix. It's a different kind of compound, and all these steroids, like testosterone and estrogen, progesterone, are derived from cholesterol. Cholesterol is a lipid, and so cholesterol, if you have too much, is bad, but if you don't have any at all, that's bad too, because then your body can't make testosterone or progesterone or estrogen, right? So your body has to have the right concentration of cholesterol. Let's take a look and see how hormones are secreted. There are three ways that we can classify that: hormonal, neuronal, and hormonal. Humoral, neuronal, and hormonal. Let's take a look at this slide. For humoral, it means that a gland is going to secrete its hormone based on the concentration of another chemical in the body. That chemical is what we call a humor, okay, that is dissolved in water. Here are the parathyroid glands. They secrete parathyroid hormone. They're embedded in the thyroid gland. Here is blood supply to the parathyroid glands. If there's low calcium in blood, the parathyroid glands are going to release a hormone called parathyroid hormone, or PTH. Parathyroid hormone, okay, acts to increase blood calcium. So the stimulus was low blood calcium. The response is to increase blood calcium to bring it back to normal. Where does your body get this calcium from? Your bones, right? So when your blood calcium decreases, parathyroid hormone stimulates the breakdown of bone to bring calcium levels back to normal, right? And that's one of the reasons why we all suffer from osteoporosis as we get older, right? Because we have low blood calcium, right? And that could be due to a number of reasons. That's humoral. Neuronal stimulus. Right, let's look at this adrenal medulla. We're familiar with this already. Here is a sympathetic nerve going to the adrenal medulla, and that is a preganglionic fiber that goes to these chromaffin cells. When this preganglionic fiber releases neurotransmitter, these chromaffin cells will release norepinephrine and epinephrine. And what happens to that epinephrine and norepinephrine? Get picked up by a capillary and go everywhere in the body, carrying that sympathetic signal. What kind of nerve fiber is this one that goes all the way to the adrenal medulla from the spinal cord? It could maybe give me a couple answers, but here is the first good answer. Your choices would be preganglionic fiber or postganglionic fiber. This one right here. This is the preganglionic fiber. It's coming directly from the spinal cord. The chromaffin cells within the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber. Right? Remember, every preganglionic fiber will secrete what kind of neurotransmitter on the postganglionic cell? It's always going to be acetylcholine. Right? It's always acetylcholine. Right? That would be an example of neuronal stimulus. Hormonal stimulus is when an endocrine gland listens for another hormone that's circulating in the blood, which means that an endocrine gland can have receptors. Right? So here is the hypothalamus, part of the brain, and it is an endocrine gland. It secretes hormones that get picked up by the blood. They go through this blood vessel, through this pituitary stalk, which we call the infundibulum, via this blood vessel, where there's another capillary in the anterior pituitary. Then the cells of the anterior pituitary, if they have a receptor, will secrete a second hormone. Right? There are some examples. Thyroid hormone can be secreted by the anterior pituitary. Thyroid hormone goes to the thyroid gland, which changes the activity of the thyroid gland. So what does the thyroid gland have so that it can be controlled by the anterior pituitary? It's got to have a receptor, right? Just like these cells up here have to have a receptor from a hormone from the hypothalamus, all these cells have to have a receptor, and then the brain helps control what the thyroid gland secretes. Right? Another example. Hypothalamus secretes a hormone, goes to the anterior pituitary. These cells, or some cells, have a receptor, right, which then release adrenal corticotropic hormone, or ACTH. ACTH goes to the adrenal cortex, and it stimulates the adrenal cortex to secrete a second hormone. Right? And these things would be like cortisol. Okay, would be one. Aldosterone would be another. Maybe for example. And then even the testes right here will secrete. What does a testes secrete? What is a testes? What hormone does a testes secrete? Testosterone. That's right. So these cells of the testes have to have a receptor for a compound, a hormone that comes from the anterior pituitary. Right? And remember, these cells of the anterior pituitary have to have a receptor for hormones that come from the hypothalamus. So your brain, the hypothalamus, is really controlling what the testes are doing. Okay. All right, so if this gonad here was an ovary, what would be the hormone secreted by it? If this was an ovary instead of a testes, what hormone would be secreted by, okay, an ovary? It wouldn't be testosterone. It would be estrogen and progesterone from an ovary. All right, so those are the three classes: humoral, neuronal, and hormonal. So one important, really important endocrine gland in your body is this pituitary gland. All right, it secretes a number of different hormones. Structurally, if we look at the pituitary gland, it has two main divisions. There's an anterior part and a posterior part. The regulation is a little bit different. The hypothalamus controls both, right, but in a little bit different way. Let's take a look and see how that works. Okay, so here is that pituitary gland in the cella turcica of the sphenoid bone, right there. And then here is the hypothalamus right here, thalamus above it. And then in a lot of animals, this pineal gland is up over here above the hypothalamus, so sometimes it's called the epithalamus, but we're interested in the hypothalamus right here. All right, so here is the anterior lobe, posterior lobe. The connection between the hypothalamus and the pituitary itself, both of these lobes, is sometimes what we call the pituitary stalk. Or it has another name, it's called the infundibulum. The infundibulum is a bridge between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And a lot of times, what do we call a bridge in anatomy between major parts of the brain? It's called a peduncle. Remember the cerebellar peduncles, cerebral peduncles. So this is like a peduncle. Infundibulum is like a peduncle, but it's a really small peduncle compared to those others, compared to this cerebellar and cerebral peduncle. So If somebody wanted to call an infundibulum a peduncolito, you could do that, right? Because everybody would know what you're talking about. All right, so signals go from the hypothalamus to the pituitary via the infundibulum or the stalk. All right. Here is one way that that happens. So here is the hypothalamus. It has neurons. They receive information from all different parts of the brain. They will send electrical impulses down to these terminus of the axons. They will release a neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter gets picked up by the capillary in this region, carries that neurotransmitter to a distant location. Some cells in the anterior pituitary have a receptor, and then it will change the activity of those cells secreting a couple of different hormones. All right, so can you tell me that compound that is released by the hypothalamus and it gets to the anterior pituitary, is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? It is secreted by a neuron, so it's a neurotransmitter, but it's also picked up by the blood and transmitted to the anterior pituitary, so it also is acting like a hormone. So here is another example of a compound that is a neurohormone, right? Is the best way to think of that, right? So here is another location where we have a really good example of a neurohormone. These go to the anterior pituitary, and here are basically six hormones that the anterior pituitary releases. Thyroid stimulating hormone. What does thyroid stimulating hormone do? It stimulates the thyroid gland to secrete its hormone, which is thyroxine. Follicle stimulating hormone. What is its job? It stimulates a follicle into growing. Follicles are something that females produce, right? And follicle stimulating hormone also stimulates the production of sperm in individuals that can't make eggs but can make sperm, right? LH is important. It controls reproductive behavior, not behavior, but function in the female. It produces ovulation. In the male, it helps the testes secrete testosterone. ACTH stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. This goes to the adrenal cortex to help the adrenal cortex grow and secrete its compound. Growth hormone goes everywhere in the body. It helps growth of muscle and bone during development. If it's not secreted when somebody is growing up, then of course they'll be really small in stature. PRL is a compound that helps the development of glandular tissue of the breast. PRL. All right, so what's the name of a compound from the hypothalamus released by these axons that are going to go to the anterior pituitary to cause the anterior pituitary to release TSH? It's not too bad. All right, so on the board, I'm going to draw hypothalamus. There's the stalk, right? So then here is the anterior pituitary. Here's the posterior pituitary. And the anterior pituitary is going to release TSH. What's the name of the compound that's released by the hypothalamus that goes to the anterior pituitary? Well, if the anterior pituitary secretes TSH, what's released by the hypothalamus, okay, which goes down to the anterior pituitary, is called thyroid stimulating hormone, same as this one right here, but we've got to put a dash. We're going to put releasing hormone or releasing factor. It could be RH or RF. All right, so TSH, RF from the hypothalamus causes the increase of TSH from the anterior pituitary. That causes the release of thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland. That's how it's controlled, by your brain and anterior pituitary. What's another one? ACTH. Anterior pituitary secretes ACTH. That goes to what? The adrenal cortex. How does the anterior pituitary know to release ACTH? Because the hypothalamus releases a compound called ACTH-RH. And remember, these RHs are neurohormones because they're released by a neuron, but they travel through the circulatory system to get to the anterior pituitary. This is a special kind of circulatory system, right? Usually we have one capillary before blood goes back to the heart. In this particular system, we have a capillary in the hypothalamus, followed by a vessel, which is not a capillary, to a second capillary in the anterior pituitary. And a system that has two capillary beds back to back with an interconnection between them is called a portal system. And this one right here is called the hypophyseal portal system because hypophysis is another name for pituitary, a portal system. We're going to look at a couple of different kinds of portal systems after we get into the vascular chapter. All right, so releasing factors or releasing hormones go through this portal system to the anterior pituitary. How is the posterior pituitary controlled? All right. Well, there are nerves that go through the infundibulum directly into the posterior pituitary. They will release a neural hormone that gets picked up by the blood. So the posterior pituitary releases hormones that go everywhere in the body all by itself. And here it is. So here are some groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the hypothalamus. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system? This is just a little recapitulation. It's called a nucleus, right? So here is one nucleus. Here is the paraventricular nucleus, means on either wall of the hypothalamus. Para means on either side, right? Supraoptic nucleus, it means that it's right above the optic chiasma. These are the nuclei, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Axons move through the infundibulum, right? And these are myelinated axons. So what do we call a group of myelinated axons that are in the central nervous system? What do we call myelinated axons in the central nervous system? That is a tract, right? A tract. So it is white matter, not gray matter. And this one right here is called the hypothalamic hypophyseal tract. And this says hypothalamic because they come from the hypothalamus. And where do they go? They go to the hypophysis, which is another name for the pituitary gland. So here is that tract. There's no portal blood vessel. When these neurons release neurotransmitter, or neurohormones is a better way, the cells of the posterior pituitary, if they have that receptor, can release two hormones. And the names are oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone, ADH. Oxytocin is an important stimulator of smooth muscle. Right? And this is especially important in women because what kind of muscle is the uterus? Is it cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle, or smooth muscle? It's smooth muscle, right? So oxytocin is released during parturition, and that causes the contraction of the uterus, very powerful contractions. I've never had a baby, but I'm every time I've seen somebody in delivery, they're kind of screaming, so I'm sure these are very powerful contractions. That's stimulated by oxytocin. Okay, oxytocin is also important for the milk letdown reflex when an infant is nursing, and again, that causes contraction of smooth muscle. Oxytocin, important for parturition. Antidiuretic hormone comes from the posterior pituitary. And what does a diuretic do? What does a diuretic do? If you're taking a diuretic, what does it make you do? Yeah, it makes you pee, right? It makes you lose fluid from your body. But there might be times when you become dehydrated because you're not drinking water. Maybe you're sweating a lot. You become dehydrated. And that's the job of anti-diuretic hormone. So if a diuretic makes you pee, anti-diuretic hormone stops or reduces the volume of urine that you're producing, which then helps your body conserve water. It helps you maintain water. So a diuretic makes you lose water. Anti-diuretic hormone helps you maintain water inside your body. All right, so what are the effects of those two things? What would you say? What's the relationship between a diuretic and antidiuretic hormone? They are antagonistic to each other, right? And that helps maintain balance of water inside your body. Okay, so those are the two parts of the pituitary gland. Okay, but the anterior pituitary. There's one thing that probably I need to go back and show you. Here is the anterior pituitary controlled by the hypothalamus via releasing factors through this portal blood vessel. Here is FSH and LH. These two things, FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone, will have an effect on the testes or ovary. What's a general name for a testes? And it's the same general name that we would use for an ovary. What do we call those things? Oh, I have to go back too far. Oh, here's one. All right. A testes is called a gonad. An ovary is called a gonad as well. Both are gonads. All right. FSH and LH go to a gonad. So sometimes these two together are called gonadotropins. These are called gonadotropins because they go to the gonads. That's where they have their effect. So the releasing factor is called GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone or releasing factor. All right, so gonadotropins refer to what FSH and LH together because they go to the gonads. They have a little bit different effect on the gonads, but still the target tissue is the same. All right, so we talked about these right here, posterior lobe, all that is good. Thyroid gland. Let's take a look, see if we can find thyroid gland. Ah, here's thyroid gland, right? And you feel this point in your throat right here. That's part of, we're going to look at it, part of something that allows you to breathe, but it also makes sound when air passes through it. It gives you voice. And right below that point, you can feel that point. Just below it on either side is the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland is controlled via hormonal mechanism, via what? Thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary causes the thyroid gland to release thyroid hormone. And sometimes thyroid hormone is called T3 or T4 depending on the number of iodine elements that are bound to that particular hormone, right? Because the thyroid hormone requires iodine in order to have an effect. Sometimes 3, sometimes 4. If it has 3, that's the most potent form. T4 can be converted into T3. Okay, and it causes the thyroid gland to secrete TSH, right, and also to make the thyroid gland grow. The thyroid gland can also secrete another hormone based on the concentration of calcium that's in the blood, and that's called calcitonin, right? Calcitonin has the opposite effect of parathyroid hormone. So I think we said parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. Calcitonin, on the other hand, right, will decrease blood calcium. When blood calcium is too high, it causes the decrease of calcium. So how would calcitonin decrease blood calcium levels? By stimulating bone growth. That calcium goes from blood into bones, and also the excretion of calcium in urine. And so calcitonin and parathyroid hormone are antagonistic to each other because calcium is such an important regulator of what synaptic transmission and muscle contraction as well as bone, which supports your body. So there are two antagonistic hormones. Oh, here's that parathyroid gland, which we talked about on the posterior side. Can I see it? Ah, the parathyroid glands embedded in the thyroid gland. Right, increase the concentration of calcium. Right, calcitonin decreases, parathyroid increases calcium concentration. The adrenal glands. Well, we got two parts of the adrenal gland. The cortex and the medulla. Right, so here's the adrenal gland. This thing right here, anybody know what this bean-shaped structure is? You're going to be able to recognize this pretty soon. That is a kidney. Okay? On top of the kidney is the adrenal gland. Another name for a kidney is renal gland. Adrenal means on top. Adrenal gland has two parts, the cortex. And what part of an organ is the cortex? Is it deep or superficial? It's the superficial part, right? And what's the deep part of an organ called? The medulla, right? Same thing for the adrenal gland. The adrenal cortex secretes hormones like cortical steroids, and which help regulate glucose metabolism inside your body. So it's an example of a glucocorticoid. It also secretes aldosterone, which regulates sodium in your body, which is a mineral, right? So, and aldosterone would be an example of a mineralocorticoid. And these are both steroids derived from cholesterol, just like estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, which help regulate glucose metabolism and sodium metabolism inside your body. So sodium in its ionic form, and that helps regulate all the electrical properties of your cells in your body, right, which has to do with nerve transmission and muscle contraction and basically all those other things. Every cell has electrical properties in your body. Right? Aldosterone, that's an example of a mineralocorticoid coming from the adrenal cortex. Glucocorticoid is an example would be cortisol. Again, that comes from the adrenal cortex. And the adrenal medulla, we've talked about before. These cells are acting it is a part of the sympathetic outflow pattern. So what part of that sympathetic outflow is the adrenal medulla acting like? Remember, for every autonomic outflow pathway, there's got to be a preganglionic cell and a postganglionic cell, two neurons to get from sympathetic nervous system to effector organ. What do these cells of the adrenal medulla act like? The preganglionic or postganglionic? It's the postganglionic cell. Then you should also know what is the chemical or the neurotransmitter released by the sympathetic postganglionic cells. Neurotransmitter for sympathetic postganglionics are norepinephrine. That's right. So the adrenal medulla, since it's acting like a postganglionic sympathetic cell, releases norepinephrine, but also another form that's a little bit more long-lasting in your body, and it is epinephrine, right? So both epinephrine and norepinephrine are released from the adrenal medulla when it receives nerve impulses from the preganglionic sympathetic neuron, which passes right straight through that sympathetic chain via a splanchnic nerve. Okay. Well, I think in lab, the last thing that I want to talk about, maybe I'll finish this up in lab first, is the pancreas. Right. Pancreas is really important, so I don't want to ignore it. Where is this pancreas? Oh, here's a really good picture of what the adrenal medulla. Oh, here, adrenal medulla. And here's a preganglionic fiber going to it. When acetylcholine is released by the preganglionic fiber, these cells of the medulla release epinephrine and norepinephrine, carrying that sympathetic signal everywhere in your body. Right, and that broad stimulation of every place in your body by the sympathetic nervous system is pretty much a hallmark of what the sympathetic nervous system is known for. Right, it has a broad-based effect. Parasympathetic is discrete. It can go to one organ at a time very easily. Sympathetic nervous system pretty much goes everywhere in your body. And where is that pancreas at? Well, here are some abnormalities. Maybe we get to talk about, here's the pancreas in your abdominal cavity. All right, so let's finish that up in lab. So we'll take a little bit of a break. And does anybody have any questions over what we've talked about so far today? Yes, question. Okay, epinephrine, what does it do? Epinephrine is released by the postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system. So norepinephrine supports anything involved with the fight or flight mechanism in your body, right? Sympathetic fight or flight, which is what? Increased respiration, increased heart rate, pupil dilation, anything that supports that. Remember, parasympathetic is not fight or flight. Para is rest and digest. Sympathetic is fight or flight. So norepinephrine released by the postganglionic neurons, increased heart rate, increased respiration. Norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla do the same thing. And epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla do the same thing. It stimulates your heart rate, but also force of contraction of your heart. If you ever thought you're going to get into a car accident and die, if that's ever happened to you, and you notice your heart, not only is it beating fast, if you really thought you were going to die, okay, it's like jumping out of your chest because it's beating so vigorously. So fast and vigorous, those are the effects of norepinephrine or epinephrine on the heart. So if somebody's heart stops, what might you want to give them? Acetylcholine right in the heart or norepinephrine? Yeah, to stimulate the heart, see if you can get it back working again. Right? Take a big syringe of epinephrine or some other compound, epinephrine, jab it right into the heart, release it. Probably seen that on a TV show sometime. Right? Heart stopped. Jab them with a big needle. Okay, in the heart. So that's what epinephrine does. Right? A powerful agonist of the sympathetic nervous system. Not antagonist, but agonist. Okay, that's it for lecture for today.